Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Tux. I'm Mike Collins. Across the country, commercial real estate has faced challenging times. The pandemic resulted in an exodus of workers from office buildings as work from home took hold. In many places, returning to those offices has been slow, resulting in a lot of vacancies and a devaluation of that space as owners end up selling for less than they paid. Charlotte certainly experienced that, particularly in older buildings and those located uptown, but elsewhere, developers have been building and expanding office, retail, and restaurant space, while others have worked to repurpose office space into apartments. And each week, it seems big banks and other national companies are announcing plans to expand here, all of them eyeing the purchase or rental of commercial property. Why is Charlotte different? Who's winning? Who is losing? Ashley Fahey has been writing about this for the Charlotte Ledger, where she is managing editor. She is here along with Peter Grant, who's going to give us a more national perspective. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Good morning, everybody. Welcome.
Morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Ashley, I'm going to start with you with the Charlotte View. It wasn't that long ago that you and I and others on this program, on several programs, were talking about Charlotte's uptown vacancy problem and looking to find ways either to lure businesses back or to convert those office towers into residential spaces or something else, or to tear them down. That's over now?
You know, Mike, we've had a spate of announcements. We've had a lot of companies saying they're expanding into Charlotte. We've had longtime players taking down big blocks of space in Uptown, South End, even South Park. But I would still say that we're not out of the woods yet. A lot of the buildings that have sold in Uptown in the past couple of years, you know, they're selling for 50, 60% less than what they were previously valued for, which that's good that they're trading because it shows that there's someone who sees value in that building and wants to do something with it. But that's still a big markdown in value. And that eventually has implications for tax revenue. We are starting to see some of these big vacancies get filled by some of these companies that are coming in. We know, for example, Sumitomo, Mitsui Banking Corp, they're probably going to be taking a big block of a dated office building, putting a lot of capital into that building and making it more appealing to the modern workforce. But I would still say there's still a handful of buildings that are struggling with this question of what do we do with this space? It's very dated. Is it worth putting a ton of capital into it? Will companies want to move here? So we're definitely in a much better spot than we were a couple of years ago. And I know I've been on this program before talking about how are we going to solve this issue. It feels like we're finally getting that momentum, but I think there's still a lot of questions about some of the older buildings, especially maybe in Uptown, and we'll just have to see where some of these big corporate projects land.
Yeah, we've always had old buildings. Peter, as she was talking about this, it just occurred to me, you're in New York. The Empire State Building has been around since the 1930s, the Chrysler Building similarly so, and there are other buildings in New York that predate the 1960s or are from the 1960s. Has this always been a problem? Has this being older been a bad thing?
Well, it has been an issue continuously as new modern space has appeared on the market and tenants have gravitated to those spaces. But there's always been a reuse for the older buildings in places like New York. New York, in a way, though, is an exception to the rule today because demand is so intense for office, and also the population growth is there. And it's just such an attractive place for tenants and workers that it's almost a case in itself. You really have to look at other cities around the country, I think, to understand the fundamental sea changes that are taking place right now in the commercial real estate world.
I was just going to say, was all of this precipitated by the pandemic? In other words, had there been no pandemic, would we be talking about this morning?
That's an excellent question. Actually, the answer is what the pandemic did was it accelerated trends that were already in place. I mean, Zoom was already a factor. We all remember WeWork, which was a growing thing in the office market leading up to the pandemic. That was reflective of all these technological changes that were taking place, workplace changes, desire for amenities in the workplace, and more companies throughout the country were recognizing that they didn't need to have people in their office all the time, that they could do things with technology. They could do things with this newfangled thing called Zoom. But then the pandemic hit. It cleared out all the office districts throughout the country, and it accelerated all these changes.
And of course, it resulted in this work from home phenomenon. Ashley, just 2 years ago, the Census Bureau issued a report that Charlotte almost topped the nation in the number of people who were working from home. At the time, 31.3% of people were working from home then. Have we experienced a measurable change in that?
I don't know the latest statistic on that, but because we have such a concentration of financial services, this is an industry and professional services that has been very aggressive and gung-ho about getting workers back to the office. We know Truist, of course, headquartered in Charlotte, has a mandate now of workers being in the office 5 days a week. As far as I know, a lot of the other banks are also looking at multiple days a week. Maybe they eventually move to a 5 day a week kind of model. And that, of course, means you need more real estate because you have more workers in the space. You know, I hear anecdotally some of the banks are busting at the seams that they're in their spaces currently right now. And with all the kind of influx of activity we're seeing, all those companies are in the same sector. And they're, again, very gung-ho about being in the office. You know, some of the other industries that are a bit prolific in Charlotte, like tech, haven't been maybe as bullish or aggressive about going back to the office. But I think when you think about the office-using employment in Charlotte, those are groups that want their workers in the office.
According to a number of different reports, Charlotte ranks among the top 10 best cities to live in the United States. North Carolina has been rated the best state for business in the country. Charlotte was rated number 2 as best U.S. city for a company headquarters. We're in the top 10 most livable cities. We're considered number 3 on the list of the best real estate markets in the country. You can take these surveys for what they are, or you can believe them or not, but that's what we're told. Is that why things are apparently better here than they are in other cities, Ashley?
I would say yes. I mean, a company isn't going to make a big investment, whether it's real estate or workforce or whatever, unless they feel like this is going to be a place where they can succeed, whether it's the tax climate, whether they could actually attract the workers that they want to. And of course, we know we have a huge deep bench of banking talent, which would explain all this sort of activity I think we've been seeing in the last several months, frankly. And, you know, the cost of living compared to a place like a New York, you know, that's a compelling argument to make for some of these folks. So, yeah, I mean, I would say all these are reasons why people are coming in.
But we're not just in competition, Peter, with New York, obviously. We're in competition with more mid-sized cities around the country. And Dallas comes to mind. You recently wrote about Dallas, and I'm told that there are a lot of comparisons between Dallas and Charlotte in certain ways. And they're very similar to Charlotte in terms of how they're doing right now in this recovery period. What is the story there?
It's interesting. We used to always.
This is for Peter. Well, this is for Peter. He just wrote an article about it.
Go ahead. Ashley, feel free to talk about Charlotte because I'm much less familiar with Charlotte than I am with some of these other markets. But I think what we're seeing in Dallas is what we're seeing in a lot of sort of Midwestern, Western, Rocky Mountain cities where. In the 50s and 60s and 70s, they had these financial districts, office districts with very little other uses that were developed. Those districts have essentially become obsolete in those cities. Now, I don't think that's quite the case in Charlotte with the financial services industry, but in a place like Dallas, because of demographics, because of the developments of all these sort of splintered business districts throughout the region, there's the need for this downtown where people would have to commute and people really don't want to go there as much as because then they're spending their time commuting. They're far further from home, further from their kids. Those districts are facing major challenges, which they're really not solving, and they're going to be, they've all sort of turned into these experiments for what these financial districts are going to become in the years and decades to come as they approach, because they're just not going to go back to the way they were.
Ashley.
Yeah, Peter, you make a good point with that. I mean, I think historically Charlotte's Uptown was kind of seen as that. It was seen as this, it's a business district. You know, they used to say they roll the streets up at 5 o'clock. I would say in the last 20 years, it's even before the pandemic, it's gotten more mixed use, more housing in Uptown, more amenities and cultural offerings. But I think the proliferation of South End underscores this point. A lot of companies have moved out of Uptown to South End, which of course is very dynamic. There's a lot of restaurants, nightlife, things like that. It's seen as kind of the hot new neighborhood. So the question has always been, will South End cannibalize all the corporate activity out of Uptown in this kind of post-pandemic world? And I think we're starting to see a little bit of a shift back to Uptown, but there was a couple of years there where you were seeing all these companies, I mean, Moore and Van Allen, LendingTree, kind of picking South End for all those, for that dynamic sort of mixed-use environment. But like I said, you are starting to see a little bit more momentum in Uptown, but I think that trend has also played out in Charlotte.
Yeah, South End, I think, was going to be, I think, was originally viewed as a residential area, and suddenly all these businesses and corporate headquarters and skyscrapers are going up in South End, even as in Uptown, people are moving in to live in Uptown. What used to be essentially a big business park is becoming a residential area. Are we just seeing a melding of these two areas, Ashley, and they're just becoming live-work-play zones?
I think that's what a lot of city leaders would like to see, is that Uptown and South End become a little bit more seamless. I mean, we have a physical project underway now with the rail trail bridge that are actually going to better connect these two districts that for so long have been very distinct. Uptown was the where you went to work, and South End, as of recently, was where you went to go live. But I think the goal, and a lot of people would like to see a bit more of a mixed use environment in Uptown, and you know, the office is obviously well underway in South End. So I wouldn't be shocked if that eventually was the case, but I think South End still has a lot of wind under its sails, so to speak.
When Peter wrote about Dallas, he talked about a kind of a flight of business to the suburbs in Dallas for all the reasons he just spoke about: shorter commutes, being closer to home, and of course, new office space. And we're experiencing that in South End, where these new buildings are going up. We're experiencing that, I think, to a great degree in South Park. We're experiencing it in the Ballantyne area. Are those the winners? Is that where the growth is going to be in the next 10 years, or is this a temporary blip? And where is the most serious problem, Ashley, in Charlotte?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the suburbs are interesting because there are some submarkets in Charlotte that have almost 50% vacancy. Like, their office product is not desirable by anyone. It's outdated. A lot of these sites are being rezoned for housing because those office buildings just aren't leasing. But then you look at a South Park or a Ballantyne, and those projects are doing great. And in fact, South Park's going to run out of space seemingly by the end of the year. So it really is depending on, are you in a sort of that mixed use environment? Are you where people want to be? With the post-pandemic trends, people don't want to do long commutes anymore. We're talking about 77 every week on this show, and you know, people just don't want to do that anymore. So can you locate in the suburbs and be more attractive to your workforce? But what suburb do you locate in? This is the calculus companies are doing right now.
Of course, if you locate in the suburbs, there's no interstate to carry you there. So, and our streets are not necessarily designed for that kind of everyday work, home traffic and shopping traffic that has occurred. When we come back, I want to talk about conditions elsewhere in the country and what the trends are there, and this rush to quality, whatever that means to people who are in the office business and the office building business. We're here with Ashley Faye. She's managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Peter Grant is a reporter on real estate for the Wall Street Journal. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about commercial real estate, the boom, the bust, the good, the bad, the ugly, here this morning with Ashley Faye, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger, and Peter Grant, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Peter, off the air, you brought up something I hadn't planned to talk about. I think we should talk about it, and that is some of this flight to the suburbs as people start going back to work. Maybe driven in some cases by a fear of these crowded urban areas because of homelessness and crime, the perception of crime. Our crime rate in Charlotte is down, but our homeless rate is up. There are homeless people all over the uptown area and infiltrating out into the other areas of the city. What role is that playing in people deciding they don't want to come back to the inner core of a business district, but they'd rather work in the suburbs?
In many cities around the country, particularly West Coast, Rocky Mountain cities, it's been a major, major issue. When people left the downtown districts during the pandemic, homelessness and crime became much more perceptible and probably a lot worse. We saw homeless encampments in numerous cities, in San Francisco, especially in Denver and Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, San Diego. All these cities all of a sudden had major problems with homelessness, and that they became major discouraging factors for employers wanting to bring their workers back there. I mean, you can talk about commutes, you can talk about amenities, but if employees feel unsafe, that ends the discussion right there. And for many tenants, that was it. And these problems are beginning to be addressed in many of the cities. For example, the new mayor of San Francisco has done a lot. He's getting a lot of kudos from the business community for finally dealing with it. But in many cities, even where there supposedly has been progress, you walk around, you think, wow, I can understand why people don't want to be here. And that's a major consideration that cities are still just in the process of dealing with.
And Ashley, we know Charlotte City Council has been working on this problem. I don't know what they can do about it, but they are concerned about it and they are working about it. I haven't heard anybody in the business community talking about this publicly. Are they talking about it? Is it a concern?
Yeah, I would say they are. It's you know, it's something that I think comes up in things like probably Center City Partners board meetings and things of that nature. No, they haven't gone out and maybe talked about it as publicly as our elected officials, but it is on the mind, I think, of a lot of folks right now. And to Peter's point, it has a big influence into where you decide to put your office or where you feel comfortable doing that. You know, I know the new, relatively new CMPD chief, Estella Patterson, she's done a lot as far as addressing Uptown specifically, knowing that there's a lot of still corporate investment in Uptown. A lot of our big companies based in Charlotte still have major operations there. I mean, we can talk about folks moving to South End and some of these other places, but the fact is Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and others, Duke Energy, still do have major operations in Uptown. So I think it's something that the business community is paying attention to and is watching. But, you know, there's a big difference between South Tryon Street and North Tryon Street. And I'm curious to see, you know, will North Tryon eventually start to develop and will we start to see some activity there. People have been hesitant to move forward on some things there, but it's a big factor, I would say.
You know, I've been here since 1983. North Tryon Street has always been a problem. People have always talked about wanting to develop North Tryon Street. What seems to be the problem there, Ashley? Why won't people move above Tryon Street or Trade Street?
It might be a couple of things, but one thing I'll note is that it's a lot of blocks owned by just a couple of entities. And those entities, including the county, is one with the Hal Marshall site. You know, they've been just very kind of deliberate as far as what they want to do there. Is there a market for it? And right now, I think you have to question, is there a market for a big office tower right now on North Tryon Street? I'm not sure that there is. But if you build a Publix there, which is supposed to come, maybe that starts to bring the activity. Maybe values start to become more attractive. Maybe you feel like I can build an office building and charge the rents I need to in order to do that project.
So there are good and bad areas of any city, Peter, and there are boom towns and bust towns at any given time. But when you look at the overall landscape of commercial real estate today, post-pandemic, how would you describe it nationally?
Well, looking at it from a purely investment focus, I would say the number of markets where institutional capital, the big money it's going to, has greatly been reduced to cities like New York, a little bit more San Francisco, but by and large, and I'm not that sure about Charlotte, I'm guessing probably Charlotte's getting some investment, but by and large, institutional capital has pretty much gotten out and is on the sidelines when it comes to investing in commercial real estate. In terms of tenant demand, it's a little bit mixed. I think Charlotte's very interesting because it's kind of in the middle when it comes to tenant demand. There is this flight to quality that we've been talking about, but at the same time, buildings are becoming obsolete, and it's going to be up to urban planners and developers to figure out new uses for them because they just don't work as office buildings anymore. So we're really in a fascinating stage. And the cities that I find the most interesting are cities like Denver and downtown Seattle and Portland, Oregon, because these are experiments that we've never seen before in urban planning. When I started at the Wall Street Journal a long time ago, it was very hard to get a story about office space on the front page. Now it's a lot easier because it's such a compelling issue. It's about where we work, where we live, how we live. So these are really important issues that we're living through today.
It's also an important economic issue because you recently wrote an article for the Journal reporting that the nation's office market is holding a fire sale with some buildings marked down more than 90%, 90%. You wrote about a Chicago office building that sold 10 years ago for $68.1 million. It recently sold again for $4 million. That sounds like a disaster. And you quoted a developer by the name of Asher Luzzatto saying, people who don't know real estate would be shocked at the level of distress among building owners who held on to property waiting for the value to recover after COVID. How bad is it? Is that a one-off example, or could you find examples everywhere like that?
That's not an overstatement. In certain cities, in Chicago, in Washington, D.C., in Denver, we are seeing buildings trade for such low numbers, it makes your jaw drop. Think of buying a 400,000 square foot office building for what it would cost for, less than $10 million. That's what it would cost for maybe a four-bedroom condo in New York City. You can buy a four-bedroom condo, or you can buy a 400,000 square foot office building. These are staggering discounts. And I am fascinated by this on so many different levels. One question I keep asking myself, and I've really never answered, is who's losing all this money? Because when I started covering real estate, it was in the early 90s, and the downturn in commercial real estate, particularly office, pushed the entire country into recession. That's not happening now, and I don't think it's going to happen now. But there are billions and billions of dollars that are being lost. And I'm very curious as to who's suffering those blows.
Ashley, I think we have some local stories to tell about the office buildings going at a loss.
Yeah, you mentioned the $4 million one. Well, Charlotte had one that sold in August for $3.5 million. It was 200 North College, which is where Wake Forest has kept its campus. Of course, Wake Forest is consolidating at the Pearl. But yeah, I mean, to your point, it's like a clearance sale right now with some of these buildings. 50% off, 60% off. The 525 North Tryon sold for $24 million. It last sold for $60 million in before the pandemic. There's this example after example, and I would assume we will see a couple more of these. But to Peter's point, this is the question that I get asked a lot, and the one I think about is, like, who's holding the bag here? We know that a lot of banks who heavily invest in commercial real estate have had to underwrite some losses here, but we haven't seen that kind of catastrophic fallout. I think one place where it is going to show up is certainly in tax revenue, especially when we do the reval, if it happens next year, which is maybe still a debate. It's crazy to see what the prices are. But I will say one kind of positive note is that at least the buildings are trading. You know, there was a period of time right after pandemic, right after COVID, 2022, 21, you weren't seeing anything trade. And it was like, what's going to happen with these properties? But the fact that someone is even paying $3.5 million for a building means they see something that they can do with that property. And maybe they have to spend $50 million to get it to a new use. But at least that eventually brings tax revenue back on the rolls.
Peter.
One of the differences between the downturn we're seeing now and the one in the early 90s, which pushed the economy into recession, was back then the bank regulators were forcing creditors, banks, to take losses almost immediately. So they had these loans on their books, and the regulators were saying, okay, you have to mark those loans down to the value of what we think those office buildings are. And that happened very quickly. And as a result, there was all sorts of ripple effects throughout the financial services industry and banking and the economy. That's not happening now, because what we're seeing now is more a train wreck in slow motion. So the banks are slowly beginning to deal with these losses, build their reserves. And so it's probably a better way to handle it. It's not putting the economy into shock, but that doesn't mean the problem is going away. And I think the problem is continuing to play out, because what we're seeing really right now in the economy and the office market is a disconnect between employment and demand for office space. After the recession of the 90s, as employment picked up, so did demand for office space. That's not happening anymore. Hmm. We are, the economy is having decent employment, but we're not seeing a increasing demand for office space to go along with that. That's now disconnected. And so that's not going to come back. And for that reason, this stress on the economy from these lost value in commercial real estate is going to continue for years.
Which makes one wonder when the proverbial you-know-what hits the fan, because you wrote, I think it was last fall, Peter, that banks that held most office mortgages have been slower to realize their losses, and many banks believed that the then-current situation would, quote, mirror past cycles where eventually the market will come back, so just give it time. And you spoke to one executive who commented, but it may not come back. Have there been any changes since then?
Right. And I personally do not think it will come back. You will not have for certain buildings, these reset values that Ashley's talking about, that's the new value. And now the question is, what can be done with buildings that you're buying for that much? Where's the demand going to come from? What kind of reuses are we going to see? In that story that I did about the fire sales, there's one amazing example in Chicago where they are literally taking an office building and converting it into urban farming. They're going to basically create farmland out of an office building because they can buy it so cheap. And there's some interesting reasons why one would want to do this. Think about how easy it is to get your produce to the market. If you just, all you need is a wheelbarrow to move it down to the green market. But I'm not saying that's the major answer, but those are the kinds of reuses and creative uses that the market is going to have to come up with.
Ashley, you hit on something that people need to know about, because the average listener is thinking, well, I don't own an office building. I don't have a $50 million investment in some skyscraper downtown. So why is this important to me? But when these commercial properties go vacant or go belly up, the taxes collected on those properties also gets lost in the shuffle. And at least here in Charlotte and perhaps around the country, the onus is then shifted to residential real estate and through property taxes. How big a problem or a challenge has that been here?
It's interesting, because when the last revaluation happened, which was after the onset of the pandemic, of course, we did see a little bit of a correction in the commercial side. But again, to my point earlier, a lot of stuff just hadn't traded. So there wasn't really that reset that I think a lot of people were sort of bracing for. But with this upcoming revaluation, which is supposed to take place next year, I think you are going to see a much bigger correction on the commercial side, because we have seen those big discounts. At least 8 office buildings in Uptown, as far as I can remember, have sold at about 40 to 60% at least less than what they were last valued at. So I think that does come out a lot. You know, historically, Charlotte has been a market where a lot of the property tax revenue has come from the commercial side, up to 70%, I think, historically. With home values having gone up so much, especially, it's been a real balancing act trying to figure out how to not put so much burden on the residential side, but also recognizing that the commercial side is losing value. And I think the new layer is what's going on at the state level, all the discussions around do we put a cap on the property tax increases, or what local governments can do as far as the residential side. So I think it's going to become a very vexing situation, especially ahead of the reval next year, to see where the commercial values go out. And I also know a lot of property owners will contest their value to be lower, and oftentimes those get approved. So I do think this is something the average person should care about, because it might affect their residential property taxes.
So, Peter, we've talked several times about this rush to quality, and I'm wondering how that's defined. What does that mean? Is it simply that it's a bright and shiny new building, or is that it's a building that's wired properly for the internet or some other new 21st century technology that a building in the 1960s wasn't constructed for? Or is it simply the amenities that new buildings are offering to attract people that could be, I would think, installed in older buildings to make them equally attractive? What is quality? What defines it?
Well, what defines quality is, in the mind of managers and CEOs, is what do I need to do to my building to help convince my workforce to get off their couches, which they got very used to doing during the pandemic, and come to the office and go through the 45-minute commute and give up the kind of flexibility they had in their lifestyle. That was a much more compelling question earlier, before the pandemic ended, when there were still health considerations. It's less so that, but more and more workers and even employers are understanding that there's less and less of a compelling reason for them to physically be in the office. So why should they go there? So employers want the amenities. They want the lounges. They want the food and beverage options. They want the gyms. So they make the office a fun, interesting, creative place for their workers to go. So in that sense, they're gravitating to the quality space that where landlords have made the kind of investments that are now making those amenities possible. And so they want views, they want the great location,
So because of all the trends that we've been talking about, including this rush to quality, it's made owners of older buildings look to other ideas to how to use them, repurpose them. And we'll talk about that and how this downturn is actually helping that. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about commercial real estate and the trends that are happening here and nationally. Charlotte appears to be doing better than many places, but we have our own challenges. Ashley Fay has been talking about that. She's the managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. And Peter Grant is with us. He's a reporter who reports on this on a national level for the Wall Street Journal. We spoke a little while ago, Peter, about how in Charlotte there have been conversations about what to do with some of these older vacant buildings, converting them into residential space and other uses. And you report that the lower valuations on these older properties that are going vacant has allowed developers to pursue redevelopment ideas that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago, for instance.
Well, there are lots of examples of this that have happened over the decades. New York has gone through a number of phases where outmoded buildings have been converted. But increasingly, cities and planners are looking at this as just a common sense solution. Because on one hand, there's a desperate need for affordable housing. On the other hand, we have all this empty office space. So doesn't it make sense for these two things to be brought together? And this is actually beginning to happen in many cities. We have an enormous pipeline of projects that are on the drawing board, but it isn't the obvious solution and panacea that many people would like, because once you get into it, it becomes harder and harder.
Yeah, we talked, Ashley, not long ago about building owners and developers exploring these conversions, turning uptown office towers into residential apartments. And one problem that we talked about was that these office towers were not designed the way apartment buildings are designed. You get in the middle of the building and there's no access to exterior light. And if you're going to live in an apartment, you don't want to live in a cave. You want exterior light. So does that remain a problem for these buildings when you're converting, or have they found some kind of magic workaround for that?
Yeah, it's requiring a lot of creativity. When you look at the buildings in Uptown that are being targeted for conversion, 400 South Tryon comes to mind. That's the gold-plated building. You know, that's been vacant for office for a while now. But you look at that building and you think, okay, maybe you could see the floor plates, but what do you do about those gold-plated windows? Like, is that going to have to be completely recladded? Like, that starts to become the question there. Then you look at the old Wake Forest office building. Those are huge floor plates, and that's just not really an ideal candidate maybe for conversion, but they still want to do residential. So it is requiring a lot of creativity. State building codes don't allow a lot of things and have certain requirements. To your point, access to a window and natural light is one. Corridors can only be a certain size. So that makes a lot of these office buildings that were built in maybe the 70s not necessarily great candidates. So even though even if a developer can buy it for $4 million, is it going to make sense as a residential unit or a hotel room or something like that?
Peter.
Well, one of the interesting things that has happened over the years as the values of these office properties has dropped is it's increased the number of candidates for conversion. Because 4 or 5 years ago, when people were first looking at conversions and looking at the prices, the values at that point, they were saying this just isn't going to work for the exact reasons that Ashley has been talking about. You need light, you need air. But now investors are beginning to pay so little that you can do these architectural hacks that never would have been possible before. For example, a big GSA office building just sold in Washington, D.C., one of these sprawling government office buildings. The developer paid so little for it that what he's talking about doing is just hollowing out the middle and building atriums in the middle. He said, "Hey, I'll put swimming pools in there." All of a sudden, you've eliminated some of the space, but he's paid so little for it. That's okay. And now you bring in light and air. In New York City, there are some buildings that you would pass them on the street, like on Third Avenue, and you would never think it would be a candidate for conversion. But once again, the architects are coming in. They say, "Well, yeah, let's just hollow out this section, and we can actually take the space that we're getting rid of and put and create a new tower." And bim bam boom, we're going to be able to create a apartments with all the necessary light and air, and it's going to meet all the building codes.
I mean, every city is a city of neighborhoods. Even New York City is a city of neighborhoods. And if you suddenly have these office towers that are being converted into residential areas, those areas of town were not designed to be residential areas. So you don't have the amenities that a lot of residential areas have or that people living there would want. I suppose that comes over time. But Ashley, one of the reasons people wanted to move uptown when we started developing residential buildings in uptown was that they wanted to walk to work. So why live 30 miles away and spend an hour on the road when you can live in a box in the sky and be right there and have restaurants and things like that and a theater to go to, etc. But if you can work from anywhere, why would you want to live in a box in the sky uptown in Charlotte, North Carolina? Is that another problem that we're facing?
I think the big question that's going to be facing a lot of folks who want to do residential conversions in Uptown is the market going to support the demand? Are the price points that you're going to need to get for those units, whether they're for rent or for sale, but they're probably going to be for rent, they're going to be probably top of market. They're not going to be these big units. You're going to have to really, you know, bank on someone wanting to live in that urban environment. But also, we have so much supply right now. We have so much apartment supply on that higher end in the urban market in Charlotte right now. You're seeing like months of concessions being offered to some of these projects. So yeah, it's going to take a couple of years for some of these projects to come online. But I do think there's a real demand question about who's going to live in these units? Where's the kind of value add for them? And would they prefer to be in a South End or a NoDa or some of the trendier neighborhoods around Uptown? So we need more housing in Uptown, and I think that's been a big focus area, a big talking point, especially more affordable housing. But how do you get there? And is the demand there is a question, I think.
Peter.
Yes, as Ashley said, price point is absolutely key. New York City is the capital of conversions right now. There's an enormous pipeline, and projects are moving from the drawing board and are actually being done. We're actually seeing this happen as you walk up and down the street. Now, why is that? Well, in New York, and I don't understand why this is, but it's almost like there's a magic mountain in New York producing people in their 20s and 30s who can afford rents of $4,000 a month for a single bedroom apartment. I don't think that's the case in a lot of other cities. You don't have that steady source of demand. And as a result, New York developers can pencil out these projects, and it's going to be a lot harder in other cities. You need that kind of level of rents, sustained rents, for these projects to work, especially given the amount of risk you're taking when you're doing these conversions, because this is not just putting up an apartment building out in a field somewhere. There are a lot of problems that come up once you begin opening up the walls of these older buildings.
We haven't talked much about another commercial sector, retail. As shopping went online during the pandemic, and a lot of people started working from home, it was more convenient, it was healthier, it was less dangerous than going out to a store and buying something. You just ordered it, and it came to your door. Luring people back to shopping centers has proven to be difficult in some areas, just as difficult as getting people to come back to work in some cases. Has technology, Peter, created some sort of new paradigm that we have to now acknowledge?
Well, it certainly has, especially for certain products. And we can all think of the products that we all will order online and not go out and shop for them. So the stores that focused on selling those products are fading a lot more. The new paradigm is that shopping has to be more experiential. That it has to be a place where you go to see other people, meet other people, more of a town square experience. Because when it comes right down to it, people like to be with other people. They would rather go out. They don't like sitting around in their pajamas all day ordering things on Amazon. But you can't just have boxes that are going to sell them things that they can maybe afford. It would cost less online, or it's a lot less of a hassle to buy them online because you're going to find exactly what you need. So, but retailers are rethinking this, and retail hasn't disappeared. It is coming back, but it has to be more thoughtful and creative.
Ashley, prior to the pandemic, when Uptown was on the comeback after a very long slump of several decades, when restaurants and bars were almost on every corner, when the city was teeming with people late into the night, most nights except maybe Monday, the city was focused on finding new ways to attract street-level retail to return. Is that still a focus for Uptown, or has a different reality set in?
I think it still is. You know, you're still seeing some vacancies on the ground floor of some of the buildings, even on Tryon Street. But the interesting thing about the retail market in Charlotte is that it's actually at the tightest it's been in a really, really long time. And I think that's because there wasn't a lot of new retail space built for so long because of all the trends you just referenced. Everyone's shopping on Amazon. There's no need to build new retail space kind of thing. So we did see an emptying out around the pandemic where restaurants simply couldn't afford to pay that uptown rent anymore, even with, you know, them working with their landlords. Some of that space has backfilled, but you walk around Tryon and some of the adjacent streets today and you'll still see some vacancy. So I think it is still a focus area. The question is, what compels a tenant that's going to bring that foot traffic and that activity to an uptown versus a south end, which is where they may want to be, just given that there's so much more vibrancy and activity right now. But you are starting to see the tide change as more maybe office users come back to uptown. That maybe makes it easier to lease some of the ground floor space.
One big hulking example of retail and entertainment vacancy is what we used to call Epicenter. It thrived for a while. It served as a place big time during the Democratic National Convention. MSNBC set up shop there in the middle of the courtyard with a live outdoor broadcast center, but then it fell on hard times. It went bankrupt. It was purchased. It was reborn as a Queen City Quarter. It too struggled to regain visitors and tenants, and now it's back on the market with roughly 75 to 76% vacancy rate. Does that tell us anything about the current retail entertainment trends here, or is that strictly a problem with that property? Because it's in prime real estate area. I mean, it's a prime property.
Yes, Mike, I think the, and I still call it the epicenter, but the, I think that property is one of the more fascinating ones in Charlotte, because on its, on paper, it should be very successful. And it has been when it was purely a nightlife destination back in the 2000s to the 2010s. I mean, you could, that place was just the place to be in Charlotte. But I know under the new kind of ownership, they were trying to position it to be a little more family friendly, a little less, you know, nightlife. There were some obviously crime issues, I think, that got some people worried about it. But I think, you know, what's really tough about this property is that it's so closed off from the street. And I don't know if that's the full reason why it's struggled, but I would wonder if a new owner would have to just completely reimagine that, just the layout and how it interacts with the area. Does it need a partnership with the Hornets or something to get it like back in motion? Because that, right now it's so vacant.
That apparently is what the city wants. They don't want to rebrand. They want to redevelop that, reimagine that property. Is that even practical? Can you find somebody who wants to come in and spend millions of dollars to do that?
I think it's going to be a tough ask to get a private developer to do that right now with where the market is. It would be a very expensive project. I'm thinking like $100 million plus probably to completely reimagine that. Charlotte has a lot going for it, but I think I think Peter said this earlier, there's still a lot of capital sitting on the sidelines. And to invest in a project like that, you'd need a lot of sort of backing. But never say never. Charlotte has a lot going for it right now, maybe one day. But I don't think it would be anything imminent, honestly.
In almost every business conversation today, the specter of AI, Peter, is looming large. In office towers that are empty now because people want to work from home, are we about to see the situation, even as they start coming back, are we about to see the vacancy rate go up again? Because we're told that AI is going to cause people at entry-level white-collar jobs to lose those jobs. Do we need that office space?
That's a subject on everybody's mind right now, and nobody really knows. We keep hearing that AI is going to be one of the most revolutionary technologies in the history of man. Maybe, maybe not. It's certainly going to have a lot of impact. What it's not going to have an impact on, though, is that people like to be together. So as long as people want to work together, there's going to be a demand for office space. But it's really true, and I think we're already beginning to see signs of employers beginning to cut back and lay off people because of AI, and that will translate into a reduced need for office space. I think we're probably going to see the continued flight to quality. I don't think AI is going to change that, but as employers need less space, they're going to be able to spend the same or maybe a little bit less money and really deck that space out. So it's going to be this top shelf space. And if you're lucky enough to have a job, you're going to have a great gym with a cold plunge and the sauna and the cafe and the restaurant. But you're right. There could be major repercussions on employment, and that will affect demand for office space.
And maybe that will affect what's just recently happened here. I only have about 30 seconds left, Ashley, but there's been this flurry of announcement by major banks moving here. JP Morgan Chase, the Japanese bank SMBC, all slated to bring SMBC is slated to bring 2,000 jobs to town. But Axios Charlotte recently reported that Dallas, Texas, is beginning to eclipse us as a banking center. Are we kidding ourselves here? It's flattery that these people are coming here, but is there more to it than bragging rights?
I would just look at who's gotten more announcements lately, and I think Charlotte will come out on top there. I know Dallas wants to call themselves Y'all Street, but we were here first, so maybe that's just my Charlotte pride talking, but I'll just put that out there.
They want to call themselves what?
Y'all Street. So
Y'all Street.
Mm-hmm. How did Charlotte not do that first?
Well, Peter, when you get cold, you can always come down here and work for the Y'all Street Journal.
That's great. Thank you.
So optimistic, are we optimistic or are we pessimistic about what's happening with commercial real estate? I'll start with you, Peter, very quickly. I have 10 seconds.
I would say I'm right down the middle. I'm fascinated. Not optimistic, pessimistic.
Peter Grant with the
Wall
Street Journal.
I'm right down the middle as well. Slightly optimistic for Charlotte.
And Ashley Fahey, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.